The committee does not yet have a quorum. The chair will gavel in at the time we do have a quorum. Until such time, we're going to start taking testimony so we can move on with this. I am not going to be doing minutes. We have a correction in the minutes for the previous meeting, so we're going to hold off until the next committee meeting to address those. I am first going to be taking up House File 2522, followed by 2521. Moving back up to Public Benefit Corporation Bill, which does not have a bill number yet because it was introduced late. So, but we're still going to be hearing it today because that was the plan. We'll not be taking action on it until next week. But we have the testifiers here now for questions and can go through it for purposes of a hearing. But for now, I'll be handing over the gavel to Representative Allen while we take up House File 2522.
Madam Chair, I move House File 2522 that it be referred to. Committee Minister, where are we referring this to?
General Register.
General Register, even better. Okay, that it be referred to the General Register. Members, House File 2522 came up because I got a call from the mayor of St. Paul when he was asked to perform a marriage ceremony said I had to get a license from a fake church to do this online, and it's kind of ridiculous. Now, people may remember a few years ago, I don't know how many years ago this was, but we had another group come in that wanted, I can't remember who they were, fire chiefs or something, but they wanted to be able to perform marriages, and I said to the guy who was testifying, well, you know what, I went online, because I've performed a couple marriages, I went online and got one of these little things, and from an online church to do it, which then you pay $5 to Ramsey County and you're registered. So I got a little certificate that says Reverend John Lesh. And he says, well, that's a, and the guy testifying said, well, that's a fake church, and I think that's ridiculous that, you know, you would have to subject yourself to that. And I was a little, you know, offended, but he was right, of course. And then when I got a call from the mayor about it, I thought, you know, he is correct. I think it would make sense in some situations for us to be able to do this. But more importantly, Madam Chair, this is a significant day to be bringing up this bill. Do you know why? Do you know what's significant about this day?
No, Chair.
Well, Madam Chair, this is the birthday of Gavin McLeod. You know who Gavin McLeod is?
Yes.
Gavin McLeod is 83 years old. He was on the radio this morning. He played Captain Steubing on the Love Boat. And Captain Steubing performed all kinds of marriages at the end of the Love Boat, which was on right after T.J. Hooker, right before Fantasy Island. I can't remember what night of the week. But at the end of the show, he'd perform these marriages. And it was the captain of a ship. You know, it was the chief person in a jurisdiction, which is why on the high seas we allowed captains to perform marriages. I think it would make sense for mayors to be able to do that as well, and maybe Captain Anderson, if he puts on the autopilot on his plane, can do the same thing on an airplane. But with that, I have with me Sarah Gruing, who's the city attorney for the city of St. Paul. Introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Sarah Gruing, and I'm the St. Paul city attorney. I'm here on behalf of Mayor Chris Coleman, who obviously cannot be here with you today and regrets he cannot join you. Thank you for asking Mayor Coleman to testify on behalf of the House files before you that are related to the solemnization of civil marriage in Minnesota. As mayor of the most romantic city in America, Mayor Coleman is often asked to perform weddings. I've worked for the mayor for 7 years, and five or six times a year he gets asked if he could officiate a wedding ceremony. And every time he asks me if he has the authority as a mayor to perform weddings, and every time I say that Minnesota is not one of the 10 states that allows mayors to perform weddings. And as you know, mayors are entrusted with significant day-to-day authority that have significant impact on people's lives. Things like police powers, the authority to set and collect property taxes, as especially relevant today, how snow plows are deployed, that sort of thing. So joining the 10 other states that allow mayors the authority to officiate weddings would be consistent with the level of authority that they already have. As Representative Lesch also mentioned, as you may be aware, Minnesota does allow any licensed or ordained minister of any religious denomination to perform weddings. In keeping with First Amendment principles, obviously Minnesota and other states do not discriminate on the type of religious denomination that it allows a person to be a minister or a pastor of. As a practical matter, what that means is that there are thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of internet churches who will ordain ministers for a fee. For example, the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster, whose followers are known as Pastafarians, regularly ordains people for $40. Also, there's a religion called Dudism that has 250,000 members, 250,000 Dudist priests worldwide. And they, all you have to do is abide by the philosophy set forth in the movie The Big Lebowski. So if you agree to abide and pay the $10, then you can perform weddings in Minnesota. If Mayor Coleman were here, he would also further offer that the state should be collecting the sort of funds that the Pastafarians and the Dudist priests are collecting, that $40, that $50, as opposed to a church elsewhere in the country. And I know that was some of the discussion behind the notary provision as well. As Representative Lesch mentioned on a personal note, Mayor Coleman recently gave up on his longstanding objection to these sort of internet churches. He's always been reluctant to go down that path out of respect for friends and family who are clergy or pastors themselves and have actually gone to school to do that sort of thing. But a dear friend and long-term city employee who is very sick asked him to perform his wedding in City Hall. So now Mayor Coleman is a minister of the Universal Life Church and performed the wedding last week. So he doesn't even need this sort of thing now. He can perform weddings on his own, but he feels really passionately that we can do better for Minnesotans and we can make government work better and thinks this is narrowly tailored to help us and the most romantic city in America do our job better. Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I can, before questions, I would add that, you know what, well, we laugh about this, and it is funny, I think. It's also somewhat serious in the sense that marriage is, in fact, an age-old and serious institution which predates recorded history. But I would note that my personal faith tradition, being Catholic, there are seven sacraments in the Catholic Church. The priests, the ordained clergy of the priests, are the ministers of each one of those sacraments, save one, because the church, theological tradition of the Catholic Church, recognizes the ministers of the sacrament in marriage to be the people who are getting married, not the the paid officiant who you would normally pay for their services and fees to administer these other types of sacraments, which I think is important in this context as well. And goes to speak to the fact of what Ms. Gruing was saying in that officiating a marriage doesn't have to be limited to your particular faith perspective, because the individuals in most faith traditions are in fact the ministers of in my tradition, what you would call a sacrament. But other than that, Madam Chair, it's time for questions.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesch, and City Attorney, I forgot to write your name down. One thing I always do when I'm looking at these bills, and I like to look at unintended consequences. And I do see some serious unintended consequences just for the city of St. Paul alone. Now let's move down the road 5 years from now. Mayor Coleman decides to retire and not run for re-election. We have a new mayor of St. Paul. And that mayor chooses not to do marriage ceremonies. Now, Mayor Coleman's done hundreds of them in this time before he retires, if this bill passes. How much liability is the city of St. Paul going to have because the mayor refuses to do service? That's an issue we need to look at. And I think we could run into some serious consequences for any city if a mayor would happen to do a service, even if it's just for a friend at City Hall or on their own, but acting as the mayor of that city and then refuses down the road. The city could be held liable for a lot of damage, and I have a lot of concern on that.
Ms. Green.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, the bill is drafted with an intent to be permissive, so as the city attorney, I wouldn't be concerned about sort of vicarious liability as a government official for those sorts of things. So we wouldn't, that would be an option for that mayor, that future mayor, to undertake those ceremonies.
I'd also note, Madam Chair and
Representative
Johnson, that currently judges would be in the same position now. I mean, the 27 judges on the Ramsey County bench perform them. Some choose not to. Some choose to charge $100 for a friend, $200 for someone they don't know. Some really don't want to do them, so if they get pestered for it, they'll say, sure, for $500. So you could raise the fee so high that would put it effectively out of reach as well.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, I see where you're going with your comment there, but unfortunately, the mayor is representing the city. The judge is representing himself.
Members, at this time, is there anyone from the public that wishes to testify?
We did have the mayor of Edina, who is going to be here, but hasn't been able to make it at this point, Madam Chair. So no other testifiers.
Members, are there additional questions? At this point, we don't have a quorum, so we can move on to the come back to this.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gruen. Representative Lesh, you want to start with your next bill? Or?
Yes, I would. And this one, Madam Chair and members, is the bill for allowing notaries to be able to perform the ceremony. And the reason I brought this bill, and I would move that House File
2521
be referred to the General Register. Now, members, the reason for this bill is, depending on your perspective, is either more important or less important than the previous bill we just heard, and that's that some people would believe that restricting certain individuals from having the right under Minnesota law to do this without having to go through an online church would be unjust. And so we should state that for those who want to be in a position or have been asked to perform wedding ceremonies, that they should be allowed to do that. I can only speak from my perspective. I can't guess as to the reason why I was first asked to perform a marriage ceremony, and I was surprised when I was asked, but some friends of mine know that I was in the seminary for 3 years, and most people around here don't think I have a religious bent at all whatsoever. But there are some who know me who believe that I do, or at least for their purposes, have a certain tradition where they would be happy to have me marry them. So that has happened. And in those cases, there are individuals, whether they be family members or friends, who are in good positions to do that. And that's why we had stated that notaries can do them, because the consideration was, if we had to create a whole new recognition infrastructure in the state of Minnesota for someone to be a marriage solemnizer, it would be quite a pain to have to do that. It'd be better if we just said, put it under the authority and jurisdiction of an existing office to which the average person would have access if they so chose, and that would be a notary public. So that's why we we expanded it to that, and I stand for questions.
Representative Lesch, I'm going to interrupt you. We have a quorum now, so I'm going to call the meeting to order. And we have questions from Representative Paymar.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Lesch says, so legislators, aren't we considered notaries too, according to?
Under statute, we are ex officio notaries public, Madam Chair, Representative Paymar. So, yes, I didn't have that specifically drawn in as far as that language, so I don't know. I'm assuming we would probably fall under it and be able to perform marriage ceremonies, but I wasn't specifically thinking of us when I drafted it.
So, okay. So we would be fall under this category then if this bill were to pass?
Upon your question and considering it, I think we would. Okay. Yes.
Representative Hoberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, to this point. It used to be that we used to just be able to do it and sign our name and reference the statute that gave us the authority. Now I believe if we want to do it, we have to get an official stamp, and there's a couple of hoops that you have to jump through in order to do it. I think there was a change like 2 or 3 years ago.
Just thinking of my career change.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Reverend Lesch. New title, I love it. I'm kind of looking at this as this really broadens the scope of where you can go get married. I mean, I in essence could actually go down to the bank, find a notary, and get married, make a deposit all in the same day. And with all the notaries out there, I just kind of worry that this kind of cheapens the whole bond of the marriage. If you can basically go to the street corner and find a notary. I know a lot of people that are just notaries that, granted they're not in the finance, but isn't that going to open up the option for people to get married in Minnesota to, tens of thousands more people that can perform the ceremony?
Representative Anderson, I think you're absolutely correct. I think that is the flip side to this debate. And if you look at who is eligible to be an officiant as a standard for how many people can get married, then it creates a problem. And I explain that in my faith tradition, the ministers of the sacrament in my Catholic faith tradition is not the officiant, it's the individuals. And throughout history, marriage has taken different forms of how it was legitimate or not. In ancient Greece, it was just if two people said, yeah, I'm with you, okay, we're married, good, that works. In ancient Rome, you had to have witnesses there. Before that, it was different. So I see your point, and I see your perspective, and it is one thing that I have to consider in this bill. But when I was weighing the interests, I decided in favor of pursuing this bill because I will say, for example, in my faith tradition, I'm Catholic, but there are many my friends and colleagues who are disaffected Catholics, especially in light of what's been going on lately, and they can't bring themselves to have a representative of the Catholic Church marry them. They're upset, they're angry about things that have happened to them, and they're not going to go get a Lutheran pastor. They're not going to get a rabbi to do it. It doesn't fit. And so they pick a friend or a family member whom they trust and whom they respect and who's been a role model for them. And I thought that in that situation that this option should be available. So that's why I brought it. But you're, of course, potentially correct.
Before we go to your question, Representative Johnson, Representative Lesch, for the record, do you move that House File 2521 be re-referred to the General Register?
I do.
Representative Urso?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems to me on the question of opening it up to larger numbers of individuals and seemingly random places you could do it, that first of all, the barn door has already been left swinging wide open on that one because of this ability to go to the internet and get the certificate that calls you ordained. But there are many people for whom, as Representative Lesh is pointing out, for whom that fake religion thing is not something they would want to participate in, to buy into. And we have far greater control over the process of becoming a notary than we do over this internet certificate thing. So I think that it really doesn't, it actually raises the bar a little rather than lowering the bar on that, I think, in terms of who would be participating in it. So I'd be in favor of it from that point of view, and in particular because we have clarified in the statute that what the state of Minnesota is participating in is civil marriage. And it does not preclude anybody's standards. You know, I myself was married in a church ceremony, and that is what I would choose to do, and that is what everybody can continue to choose to do, and it doesn't have any impact on that whatsoever. So I think it's fully in keeping with what we did last year in clarifying the difference between what the state of Minnesota is doing and what any one of our churches is doing, you know, their standards in addition to that.
Representative Anderson.
I renew my motion.
Representative Johnson, sorry.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, do you happen to know how many notaries we have in the state of Minnesota at this time?
You know, Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, I have no idea.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, besides the notaries, with the ex officio, we also have probably, rough guess, 6,000 law enforcement, 300 and some legislators, every clerk, and a lot of officials in every city, county commissioners, the list goes on and on of the ex officio that would do this, plus 60 to 80,000 other people that are already notary in this state of Minnesota. And also with the notary law, we have people that live outside the state of Minnesota that could perform services here as well, with the board the agreements we have in that statute with the bordering cities or county and states. The number that we have is just, I have no idea how we could keep track of everything. I would rather see something new set up where people can file, pay their fee with the state, do a little bit of training, and have it recorded that way. That leaves the cities, leaves the counties, leaves these government jurisdictions for somebody that decides not to do that when somebody else has done the service. It leaves the liability to that government agency out of the question by having an individual do it individually, maybe through another system set up by the state for that.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Johnson. I appreciate that. The reason I didn't go that route is because of the additional government bureaucratic network and stuff it would set up. I'm a Democrat. I like government as much as the next Democrat, at least. But it just seemed to be kind of burdensome when we have an in-place infrastructure. But I appreciate why you would want that, so we can keep better tabs on it.
Representative Urso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Regarding the suggestion that we set up a system where people would be, you know, more or less certified by the state to do marriages after going through training and whatnot, are we suggesting that we also require that for ministers, since they're marriages they perform are just as valid from the state's point of view, and the state is not in charge of ordaining those ministers and so has no control over what their previous training may have been with regard to marriage. So if we're suggesting training for one group of people, I would think that would have to apply to everybody.
Are there any members of the public that wish to testify on House File 2521? Seeing none, Representative Lesh, would you like to renew your motion?
I would, Madam Chair.
Uh, All those in favor of referring 2521 to the General Register, say aye.
Aye.
Those against?
Aye.
Motion passed. Representative Lesh, I'd like to renew your motion to that House file 2522 be referred to the General Register.
Say that number again, Madam Chair.
This is about the going back to the mayor's bill, 2522.
I think we just did 2522. We did 25.
We did 2521.
Okay, so 2522. I would renew that motion, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. Those in favor of referring House File 2522 to the General Register, say aye.
Aye.
Those against?
Aye.
So moved. We'll move on to the Public Benefit Corporation. And Representative Lesh, it's my understanding that this testimony is informational only, and the bill will come for a vote next week?
That's correct, Madam Chair. The bill was not dropped in time, but it is posted, and all the information is up on it. So the intent is to have the hearing today and then take action on it next week.
Okay, please proceed.
Thank you.
Have you go ahead and do your introduction.
Okay. Madam Chair, members, my name is Jeff Oakes, and I'm a social entrepreneur. Over my 10-year career, I've founded a successful nonprofit organization called Breakthrough Twin Cities. I also invented and commercialized a product that has won major awards and is now internationally distributed. I am most recently now interested in creating what is called a social business. And a social business is a hybrid entity form. It combines a social purpose, an official social purpose of a nonprofit organization with a private ownership structure of a for-profit corporation. And currently, entrepreneurs who are trying to start social businesses struggle in a couple of different ways. The first one is that existing corporate forms pose some legal constraints. And if you're interested in a lot of the details on that, I would refer you to the one-pager in the packet. But there's a lot of interesting nuances to that. The second constraint is that you can customize your way around certain constraints that you see by hiring lawyers who can do that work for you. But it presents extra expense in the startup process, and it also does not solve all the legal problems. It also poses some uncertainty and risk for the entrepreneur, given that there is very few cases of litigation of those forms. And also, the current entity forms that are available to entrepreneurs who want to start social businesses do not differentiate them in the broader economy for vendors, consumers, or investors. Additionally, 21 other states, Delaware to Arkansas, have passed very similar legislation to this. And we really want to keep social businesses and the entrepreneurs that are trying to create them, as well as the social impact gains, as well as the financial returns in our state. And that's one of the reasons why we are pursuing this. In addition to that, I'll just mention three other reasons why this is really important. In addition to those things that I mentioned, the Public Benefit Corporation form will give these entrepreneurs and their social businesses a distinct identity in the broader market. It will also decrease startup expenses and uncertainty. And also, the Public Benefit Corporation form will provide a standard form around which a supportive ecosystem of investors, of lawyers, accountants, program evaluators, and more will be able to develop. In short, the Public Benefit Corporation form is going to be the grain of sand at the center of a new sector pearl. I'd like to share with you today, too, that we have the support of 8 endorsing organizations, including the Minnesota State Bar Association, the Office of the Secretary of State, Co-Roundtable, Social Enterprise Alliance Twin Cities, Impact Angels Investment Group, Growth and Justice, Legal Corps, and the Social Justice Commission of St. Patrick's Catholic Church of Edina. We anticipate that additional organizations are going to continue to join our cause as the session progresses. With that, I would like to turn it over to Kim.
Okay.
Madam Chair, representatives. My name is Kim Lowe, and I'm an attorney at Fredrickson & Byron, a local law firm here in town. I'm also an active member of the business law section of the Minnesota State Bar Association, where I sit on both the business law or the corporate law subcommittee as well as the nonprofit law subcommittee. I'm also currently the treasurer of the Hennepin County Bar Association, and I'll be president of the Hennepin County Bar Association in bar year 2016. I'm also a very active legal practitioner in both the for-profit and the nonprofit sectors here in the Twin Cities and nationally. I also chair a ABA joint or task force on social ventures at the national level. And currently, I sit as the chair of the MSVA's task force that drafted the legislation that's been put before you. So I wanted to come to you today and give you a little bit of a background on the legislation that's being proposed from the legal perspective, which is what I assume people would be concerned about. Jeff gives you a great idea about this legislation from the social entrepreneur's perspective. And we look at this, and I say we, thinking about the lawyers in the room, from how this legal form will work within our existing legal structures. The committee that drafted the legislation that's before you right now was made up of practitioners, corporate law practitioners, as well as some litigators, so some trial attorneys who represented the sort of consumer protection perspective or the shareholder perspective, from that minority perspective. We also had academics from three of our four law schools that participated in this drafting committee activity, as well as many law students over the last couple of years. We've been working on this for 2 years, by the way, the MSBA and a legal committee of the MSBA. Some of those law students are even here today, and we've been very lucky to have them put a lot of time and effort into examining all the legislation that's been put in place in the 21 other states that have passed legislation like this. We've also looked at I've participated nationally with many other drafting committees from states that are currently anticipating putting in legislation like this. Part of our drafting committee also included practitioners like Jeff and some other legal business people that are in the audience today as well. And so they gave us a great deal of insight as to what the entrepreneurs are looking for with respect to social business statutes. When we drafted this statute that you have in front of you, we really were looking at creating an overlay or creating a framework that would allow a social entrepreneur to have the ability to choose this type of entity if he or she so chooses. Currently, we don't have an option available for social entrepreneurs. We wanted to create or help the state create that option, and that's what this legislation is meant to do. It provides a consistent and recognizable legal structure for social entrepreneurs so that they are clearly identified in the marketplace as social entrepreneurs or social business owners. It creates a mechanism for shareholders and investor protection by requiring certain votes in and out of this sort of structure. And it also creates an annual public reporting mechanism or obligation that is facilitated by the Secretary of State at no cost to the state that will allow investors, consumers, vendors, and the public at large to see what these social ventures or these social businesses are up to, what they let them report against what they claim they're going to do. We have a couple of nuances in our statute that make it differ from the other states that are out there. We were very conscious of the fact, and we're very lucky that we started looking at this sort of mid-life cycle of these benefit corporations' activities. So we've got the learning from 21 other states and what they've done and not done. So we took a really deep dive into looking at what other states have done with respect to benefit corporations, what they've learned, some of their mistakes, and we were able to incorporate that into the legislation that's before you.
Representative Lesh.
Take questions. I would just give a broad overview that as maybe Mr. Oaks referenced, I probably should have done earlier, but just to give an idea of what we're doing here. Historically, the reasons to incorporate a business in the United States of America is for any lawful purpose. You can do it for whatever you want, and the only thing you're accountable to is shareholders and your quarterly balance sheet, make sure you're making money. What this bill does is it provides another option whereby the corporation is then accountable for what they really want to do and not just the profit they make, because obviously these things need to be profitable. We want them to be profitable, but you can't do, as was explained to me by Stephen Young, who is also a promoter of this. You Republicans, you like Stephen Young, right? He's a good guy. So
he's promoting against it. You cannot properly capitalize a nonprofit to do this. You wanna do it as a for-profit corporation, but you need that other thing to the side that helps you deliver the services that you want to do, which is the entire point of you incorporating and doing this in the first place. So that's what we're trying to achieve here. And it's bipartisan in its support, and it's also somewhat bipartisan in its opposition, because you can think of arguments against it, depending on whether you're conservative or liberal, and you can think of arguments that are very much for it, regardless of whether you're a conservative or liberal. So, but I think it's time that we do this and give corporations an option to operate that gives them more flexibility than the handcuffs that limit them to simply the profit alone. But with that, I think we take questions, Madam Chair.
Representative Neuberger, sorry. Thank you.
Thank you. And early yet. Representative Lesh, first I want to say I really wanted to vote for your mayor's bill. I was planning on it. But getting back here to the topic at hand, I read through this last night, which I shouldn't have done, because it made me stay up later than I wanted to. And then I researched it this morning. But I've got a number of questions I would like to have discussed here in this morning pertaining to this. if we start here on just the very title of this, on line 1-7, this chapter may be cited as the Minnesota Public Benefit Corporation Act. Who decides or who determines whether or not the foundational issue or the foundational reason for the corporation is of public benefit? I'm gonna give you an example that came to my mind. Let's say you want to start a public benefit corporation to help third world countries because you believe that there's overpopulation. I don't, and one of the primary means of achieving your perceived public benefit would be abortion. What is to, who's to say that this is a benefit or this is a detriment? This is very subjective in its inception. It's very objective. So how is something first deemed as a benefit? That'd be my first question.
Madam Chair,
Ms. Lowe.
First of all, I appreciate your question because I get it very often about what is a social benefit? What is that definition? What does it mean? Now, if you're asking for a legal definition, there is no legal definition as to what a social benefit is. It is a perceived definition or a perceived value of the culture that you're in at the time. And this legislation is structured that way to allow for that freedom or neutrality as to what a group or individual perceives of as a social benefit, much like our tax code is structured that way now when it comes to charitable organizations. The example you gave could just as easily be done and is done now with charitable organizations that are tax exempt under the tax code without any differentiation. In fact, they can't be differentiated with respect to belief as to religious or you brought up abortion. So right now, exactly what you described, I can do with an organization can do under the tax code without any restriction. So this does not mean, this legislation does not attempt to go farther than the tax code, nor does it go less than the tax code. It just leaves it open for what people consider to be of social value.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Neuberger.
I have additional questions that I'd like to pursue, but I'm going to sit back here for a minute and allow other members to ask questions, should they. I don't want to hog the microphone. And
too late.
Representative Urso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are there examples of corporations that have been created in other states that are large enough and national enough that we may have heard of them?
Madam Chair, Representative, that's a great question. Just several weeks ago, a corporation that exists here in our state that does business here, Rasmussen College, just reorganized themselves as a public benefit corporation under the Delaware statute. And we actually have campuses here in the state of Minnesota. They have campuses in other states where they're operating. And Bert Black, who's in the audience, we had a long conversation about what do we do now. We've got boots on the ground, businesses that have activities right here on the ground that have now reorganized as benefit corporations under other state laws. And there's press releases, and we're considering how we deal with them, just like we deal with any other company from another state that comes here. So that's the most recent example that we have. Certainly we have Patagonia, which is a public company. We have a couple of other. California has several entities that have formed under their law that are benefit corporations. I think Delaware to date has had about 200, but most of them are small. But if you think about the large one, the Rasmussen College is the one that comes to mind right away.
Representative Yursa.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rasmussen is an interesting example since it began here in St. Paul. Because I was there's a campus not in, but on the edge of my district. So
yes.
Thank you.
And I have a question for the either Ms. Lowe or Mr. Oakes. You said this is a hybrid, so can you talk a little bit more about some of the policy implications or the liability provisions? So is the director's going to have protected if they're performing within the scope of their duties, but so address that, and then sort of what aspects of this are, does it retain the for-profit structure?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll answer you actually posed two questions. You asked a question about the hybrid nature of the entity and also the protections that exist for the governing body of the organization, the board of directors. I'll take your first question as to hybrid first. We refer to these as hybrid entities, and Representative Lash referred to them as hybrid entities, because they combine components of our for-profit entities, which have owners and have a business purpose to pursue profits and sustain their business activities through their profits, and they also distribute profits out to their owners. On the other end of the spectrum, we have our nonprofit organizations, which are purpose-driven. They don't have owners, and they are not generally sustained by operating businesses that continually sustain their activities. The social business or the benefit corporation is a hybrid because it includes the for-profit motivations, the for-profit components of the for-profit business, owners, the ability to distribute out to those owners some form of profit, and a general business purpose. At the same time, it includes the social purposes, or can include a social purpose, that is similar to a nonprofit organization. So the hybridization occurs by combining the two together. Right now, these live on different ends of a spectrum when you think about corporate purposes. A for-profit business has a general business purpose. A nonprofit is foreclosed from having a general business purpose because we define that under law as lawyers as maximizing shareholder value. The nonprofit corporation under law cannot do that. There's a pecuniary gain prohibition in the nonprofit sector. So what this entity does is it combines the two ideas into one entity that allows a board of directors or an entrepreneur to both pursue a social purpose at the same time that he or she or those shareholders are also taking some sort of or receiving some sort of personal benefit or financial gain from the business.
And Ms. Lowe, could you give me an example of how of a organization that would be serving a social purpose benefit but would make a profit? Mr. Oakes.
Madam Chair, thank you for your question. So in Minnesota, we have a sort of a up-and-coming, fairly active group of people who are operating social businesses, even though you can't identify them, you know, by a certain corporate form. And I think the example that I'd like to use to kind of illustrate what a social business would be and how it might work would be the example of Tuloco. Tuloco would like to address the issue of black unemployment. That is their social purpose, and they're doing that in a way through the creation of a mobile platform that actually really helps to promote area black businesses. And so people can come on and search very quickly for black businesses and find them in their area and really make a point to patronize them. So that is what they've identified as their social purpose, and they have some revenue-based generated models in there. But what they want to do is they want to also report out what their social impact has been through this service. So that's an example of a social business that someone is creating in Minnesota. There are many other types. Finnegan's Beer is another very well-known example. They operate a company that sells beer, and they give away profits to 100% of their profits to support food issues. So there are a lot of different models for how you might use a social business form. Those are just some examples of ones that are actually operating locally.
So, Mr. Oakes, so the profit would come from the fee for services generally?
There are a lot of different models for how social businesses can operate. There's actually a lot of new scholarship that is coming out about that. And if you think about a business, they usually sell a service or a product, and that service or a product might be the way that they deploy their social impact. And they might also use their value chain or their supply chain in certain ways to do things deliberately that might add cost to that, but also then really are deliberate about the impact they're creating. So, for example, you may try to hire a particularly vulnerable population to employ them, and that's a component of your social purpose. You wouldn't necessarily do that if your main motive was to maximize profit, but if you have a dedication to homeless youth, for example, or some other social purpose that you want to run your business for, then this form would really protect that as you grow and add owners. So there's a lot of different ways that businesses can claim to be social. There's a lot of different models out there. So it's not easy to just say there's one example.
Thank you, Mr. Oakes. And Ms. Lowe, go back to that liability question. So I can see if they're serving a truly or primarily or solely public benefit, that the getting around the unrelated business income tax is a good idea. But if the commercial purpose to this is for profit, then how do we justify extending immunity from liability to that entity?
Madam Chair, representatives, once again, you asked a couple questions. I'll get back to the liability of the boards of directors or the people who are charged with managing the day-to-day operations of a business. Under current law, under our current corporate statutes, those individuals, usually referred to as the board of directors or maybe the board of governors under our LLC statute, they are either indemnified or held harmless from liability if they take into account and make decisions on behalf of the business that take into account the best interest of the corporation. That best interest of the corporation is measured by, under current law, shareholder maximization. So as long as the decision that's being made or that they take into account how that will benefit the shareholders' bottom line, they are generally free from or can be defend against a claim that they didn't do the right thing. On the nonprofit side, our boards of directors that are making decisions with respect to nonprofit activities are governed by the purpose of the organization. So when they make decisions, they have to look to the purpose of the organization. So if the purpose of the organization is to wipe out serve poverty issues here in St. Paul, they can't all of a sudden start making decisions that allow them to deal with poverty issues in Wisconsin. It goes against their purpose. But if they want to, if that nonprofit wants to start generating some revenue to go towards that activity, they would need to do that in a manner that was substantially related to that purpose. So, for example, in the example I just gave you about trying to eliminate poverty in St. Paul, that nonprofit might say, we're going to put in place a jobs program that's going to put to work unemployed individuals here in the state of Minnesota. They can't, or city of St. Paul, they can't put in place a jobs program that only provides jobs to rich people in Edina. It doesn't work because it's not substantially related to their purpose. So that's how it works in the nonprofit world. The for-profit world has no prohibitions as to what they can do with respect to that. And so that's why that hybridization is necessary, because you can't combine the business decision-making with the purpose and the social purposes. They start to overlap in a way that sort of ties that board of directors. And for them not to be held liable, they need to have this freedom to consider both of these aspects at the same time, as well as considering other stakeholders that may exist.
All right, thank you, Ms. Law. I believe Representative Urusa was first, and then Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do not know enough about how these different business forms work. So would this provide an alternative business form for businesses that currently operate as co-ops? You know, might that be appropriate for a number of them?
Madam Chair, representatives, I just happen to be a co-op lawyer, too, so it's very handy. No, this is not an alternative to a cooperative structure. Cooperative structure under Minnesota law is either formed under 308A or 308B. A co-op is a structure, a corporate structure. It's a for-profit structure that includes a democratic governance structure, and it generally includes the fact that its members are actually patrons of the business. It's similar in the sense that most co-ops are formed out of a local or a regional concern. I represent a lot of large agricultural co-ops, and they tend to be located around an industry or around a certain crop. But those are clearly for-profit businesses that happen to have a governance structure that allows for democracy, one member, one vote, but they're not focused on a social purpose. They might be. Some of our retail food co-ops that we have locally are focusing, yeah, locally grown, or we want to provide these different services, but they do not replace each other.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I was researching into this, came across some very interesting information from National Affairs. Howard Husak wrote an article recently. And some of it, I needs to be shared here, the data, the information that pertains to this. I think right now there's a number of things that we're dancing around, and this is built on the premise that promotes the belief that corporations are bad, that corporations don't contribute to the society and the well-being of society at large, and because large corporations are bad, that they don't morality, so to speak, should be injected into this equation, and to have these social corporations to make sure that big corporations or any corporate entity behaves. The Chronicle of in its report in 2011, 13 companies, large companies, donated more than $100 million each. Of these firms, the largest contributor was Walmart, which donated $342.4 million. Such donations may be cynical marketing ploys. We're going to be honest here. But they also may be rooted in the assumption that the business has an interest in fostering healthy communities. Whatever the motive, the corporate citizenship funnels enormous revenues to organizations currently. Our corporate organizations funnel enormous amounts of money to revenues to organizations such as the Red Cross, the United Way, the Salvation Army, and local schools. According to Giving USA, the overall 2011 corporate donations of all kinds totaled $14.55 billion. So what we need to do is we need to take a sober look at this equation and say, first of all, recognize the fact, and we need to call it for what it is, that currently existing corporations do help, and they do contribute enormous amounts of money without having to have a social cause, whether it be specific or general, tagged to their their organizational purpose. That needs to be put out in front so that we're not painting a picture that says corporations are evil, we need to change them. The question that I have for our testifiers right now is, would these general benefit corporations, would they be allowed to donate money or donate to political parties or campaigns?
Madam Chair, representatives, I have a couple things to respond to. First of all, the social business movement does not imply that the large corporations are in any way less than what they are in this country, which, especially in the state of Minnesota, where we exist, and we have a huge and prosperous philanthropic community because of our large, very thoughtful corporations that I work for on a regular basis. So this statute does not intend to, nor do social business owners or social entrepreneurs in any way try to eliminate or say that there's anything bad about corporations. They exist and they do amazing things. And you cited the amazing amounts of money that our corporations provide to the charitable works that are happening in the state and around the country. You mentioned Walmart being the largest. I'm often asked, couldn't Target become a benefit corporation? Well, I'm like, you know what? Target's, we live in the world of Target. We're often hearing every week that they donate, $1 million a week to charity. And we know that the huge things that come out of in our own population are corporations like Medtronic that sponsors our marathon that we're so proud of, that sponsors our science museum that we're so proud of, all the work that Target does in this state, all the work that General Mills does, 3M, all the work that those foundations have done in this state are not to be minimized at all by a statute that allows a social business owner to say, I want to perform a business activity for myself, I want to form a business, but I also want to have a social purpose to it. They are not in competition with each other. They are a complement to each other, and they're recognizing that entrepreneurs want to have a choice in what they can and cannot do. And right now, we're missing an entity that allows for this hybrid structure. One doesn't say, they're not meant to be opposed to each other. They're meant to allow our citizens to have a choice with how they want to structure their business and how they want to go to the marketplace and present themselves to the marketplace.
Thank you, Ms. Lowe. We have one more question, and then we're going to have to wrap this up and move on to the next bill so we have time.
Madam Chair,
we will be discussing this, bringing it up next week after it's introduced.
So thank you. I just wanted to – I still would like to have my question answered. Will these –
Representative Newberg, will
yes, ma'am.
We wait till next week?
Will do.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. At this point or Representative Anderson, would your question wait till next week, or?
It can. They'll be back next week.
I'll be back next week.
And I just want to clarify that this bill has not been introduced yet. It's going to be introduced on Monday. All right. Representative Lesh, would you like to take back the chair at this point?
Sure. Thank you.
Thanks.
Representative Hortman. Representative Hortman moves House File 2213 be referred to Judiciary Committee. And we have testifiers Ron Elwood, Barb Gilmore. You can come to the testifiers table. Oh, that's right. Before we do that, well, no. Okay. Representative Hortman, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I want to apologize for being late, but I had a commitment to the second graders and the fifth graders at Edenbrook Elementary School, and I had to fulfill that commitment before I could be here. My bill, House File 2213, I think it would be faster if I just have Mr. Elwood explain it.
Thank you. Mr. Elwood, please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Ron Elwood, Legal Aid. This is a small technical bill that has very large implications on assuring marketability of title and for the buying and selling of homes in Minnesota. Section 2 is the guts of the bill, and what it does is reaffirms and strengthens longstanding Minnesota law that sets forth the statute of limitations on bringing defective foreclosure claims. The bill addresses the Curative Act, and that is 582.25. And what that does is lists a laundry list of potential defects and says that a mortgage is valid if a person doesn't bring a claim within a certain amount of time. So it creates a wall. And that wall is critical because it allows title companies to issue title insurance. It allows lenders to lend. It allows realtors to broker the buying and selling of homes, real estate sales. And most importantly, it allows all of us in Minnesota to buy and sell homes with confidence. A few recent decisions, one by the Court of Appeals and the one by the Supreme Court in Minnesota, neither actually have anything to do with the statutes that were mandated. But if you do some like legal connecting of the dots, that the potential is that a case could come before the court that could put into question whether that wall stands strong. And all this bill does is reassert your will to tell the courts that wall is impregnable. And that's basically what this bill does. Legal aid, the real property section of the Minnesota Bar Association, the Minnesota Bankers Association, the Association of Realtors, Minnesota Association of Realtors, the Minnesota Title Association, the Minnesota Credit Union Network, and the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota all came together to collaborate and come up with this bill, the Section 2. Section 1 simply makes permanent an exemption that was in last year's foreclosure bill for small servicers, and that simply allows small community banks and small credit unions to continue the exemption that they had last year, and it removes the sunset. Happy to stand for questions, and I don't know if you're here for questions.
I'm here for questions.
I want to just say who you are and who you're with.
Yes, I'm Barbara Gilmore. I'm representing the Minnesota Land Title Association, which is a trade association made up of title insurers, title insurance agent, and abstractors in the state of Minnesota. I'm also an attorney, regional counsel for a large national title insurance underwriter called Old Republic Title, which is incorporated in Minnesota. I've been there for over 20 years.
Questions from members? No questions. What's that? Oh, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Elwood, if I understand this correctly, your intent is to create a wall. I mean, that's not the full intent of the bill, but if this wall is there, could that be used to save research time for title research for back property in essence?
Mr. Elwood?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, it doesn't create the wall. It reasserts that wall that's been there for, I don't know how many years, many, 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 many years. 76 years, thank
no,
you.
It was implemented.
Oh, in 1976. Well, even so. What's a couple of years? It just makes sure that wall is still stands. It still stands as strong as it has ever stood. That it doesn't create, I just want to be clear, it doesn't create anything new. It just makes sure that is not breach, but you can answer the question on the title.
It will not.
Ms. Gilmore.
It doesn't change the research that needs to be done. We have something called the Minnesota Marketable Title Act, where we basically have to search back 40 years in the land title system to determine whether a property is marketable, and that doesn't change that. It just changes our examination of foreclosures and allows a title insurer to ignore certain defects in a foreclosure after a certain period of time.
Representative Neuberger.
Just a point of clarification. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does the MERS system, does this have any effect on how that currently operates?
Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair and Representative Neuberger, the whole purpose of this bill is to make sure that everything we're doing today continues to be done just like it is today and nothing messes that up. That's basically what this bill is intended to do, to be clear, because there's an ambiguity that's potentially created down the road potentially with those cases in this. I'm sorry.
Representative Hortman?
Well, it just clarifies the statute of limitations. The wall that Mr. Elwood's speaking about is the statute of limitations, and it's good for all of us when we buy a house to know that the title is resolved and that we have good title to the home. And that's why we have a statute of limitations on these kind of disputes. And we didn't want there to be any ambiguity about that statute of limitations in light of legislation we passed last year, I think unanimously, and some court cases. So it's clarifying.
Representative Neuberger.
I'm good. Thank you.
Oh. Representative Anderson, more questions? All the questions answered? Outstanding. Then Representative Hortman's motion to refer House File 2213 to the Judiciary Committee. We'll take a vote on it. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you. Members, as noted previously, we're going to wait to approve the minutes for the last meeting until next meeting. So there being no other business before the committee. There being no other bills before the committee is adjourned.